This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So it's the Utah Territory in the late 19th century. Mormons are campaigning for statehood, and it's not going well. This is the scholar Terrell Gibbons.
The most conspicuous excuse given was polygamy, but there were other reasons as well. Latter-day Saints had their own political party. They just radically differentiated themselves in many ways, right? So the campaign for statehood is a campaign of Americanization, of Latter-day Saints trying to fit in. I think a turning point, a critical turning point, in which Latter-day Saints effectively made a devil's deal was in 1893 at the Chicago World's Fair. That year, the very, very first Parliament of Religion in history was conducted. And the express ideal was to gather together under one roof representatives of every single religious group on the planet. They had representatives even going to Africa and asking representatives of animist religions to come to Asia, all manner of Asian religions. There was one church and one church only that was expressly forbidden to participate, and that was the Latter-day Saints.
And it's at this point that a Mormon leader named B.H. Roberts steps in. Gibbons says Roberts wasn't at all happy the saints had been left out of this parliament of religion. Other church leaders told him, just let it go, but he wouldn't.
Roberts won't let it die, and so he alerts journalists. There's suddenly a public campaign of protest. Latter-day Saints have lots of sympathizers that they shouldn't have been singled out. So the committee reverses their decision. They invite the Latter-day Saints to be represented. After the furor dies down at the last moment, they relegate B.H. Roberts to a small room in an off-street location. At the exact same moment, within days, in conjunction with the World's Fair in Chicago, there's an international choral competition. The Mormon Tabernacle Choir participates. They win the silver medal. Observers said they really should have won the gold. You can't give gold to Mormons, right? So they get the silver medal. So what is the lesson that comes out of that week? The lesson that we learn is, you Latter-day Saints are welcome to sing and dance for us, but don't ask us to take your theology seriously. Don't ask us to take your ideas seriously. And we effectively signed on. Because as recently as the morning after the Romney election, a public affairs spokesperson made a statement to the effect that maybe now we can get back to talking about what Mormons do and less about what they believe. I think that the healthiest and most productive and effective strategy that the church could employ today is to say, we're not what you may have understood Christians to be.
Today on the program, we're exploring politics and Mormonism. That is, what it means to be Mormon and politically active. And all of this started with a question by Lee Hale. He's a reporter here at KUER, host of our podcast, Preach. And Lee's here. Hi, Lee.
Hey, Doug.
And we should probably explain for those not familiar with Preach that Lee has kind of outed himself publicly as a Mormon, but also as one who himself has struggled with his religious identity.
Yeah, I'm out there.
You're out there.
I think that the important thing is I try to be honest about why I know certain things.
Yeah.
That's the main thing. It's like I don't want to be sneaky about like, oh, I've heard that some Mormons feel this way.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I'm not so much interested in weighing in on the controversial topics as just being honest about what I bring to the table.
Yeah. And this is kind of the perspective you bring to the podcast, but also your stories. Like,
right.
You just come out and say it, get it out of the way so we can move on.
Yeah, this is the world I live in. These are my people.
So what was it that you wanted to understand or figure out about Mormonism and politics? What's the thing in your mind?
Well, Mormonism obviously influences the politics of an individual, whether it's a politician or a Mormon voter.
Yeah.
And I want to know how. Like, is it the theology that's influencing them to vote the way they vote or think the way they think? Or is it something else? Because I think what would make sense is that if people put their faith first, then their theology should be evident in how they view politics. And I don't think that's actually the case with Mormons right now. And I say that as a broad sweep, but when I look at Mormon politicians, I don't see Mormon theology in their stances. I feel like if you listen to during all the impeachment upheaval that's happening, first in the House, now it's going to be in the Senate, there's people like Congressman Chris Stewart who like goes all in for Trump
and is
a huge defender in a way that a lot of people in the Christian right and the Republican Party sound.
They hate this president. They hate those of us who voted for him. They think we're stupid. They think we made a mistake. They think Hillary Clinton should be the president, and they want to fix that. That's what this vote is about. They want to take away my vote and throw it in the trash. They want to take away my president and delegitimize him so that he cannot be reelected.
I feel like anybody listening to him defend Trump, you just think like, well, this is a typical like white evangelical type, you know, politician.
Yeah.
Or Mike Lee. Mike Lee, the senator from Utah.
What we've seen is that all the evidence that we're aware of in this case shows that the president hasn't done anything impeachable. He hasn't done anything criminal. He's not even done anything wrong. President Trump succeeded where President Obama tried and failed for years to get the Ukrainian government to investigate Burisma. That's not impeachment material. That's something to applaud.
Huge supporter of Trump, very adamant in a way where it's like, yeah, not differentiated from the Christian right at all. You have maybe an outlier like Mitt Romney a little bit, but he's careful even how he pushes back. And the interesting thing is, like, to me, it seems like the Christian right include Mormonism. But the weird thing is that the theology behind Mormonism and much of the Christian right is so starkly different, the way I see it. So if the theology is so different, why do these politicians end up sounding the same?
But I guess if you listen to Mike Lee, if you listen to Chris Stewart, why would that surprise you or interest you? Because this is how – this is just how Republicans in Congress talk these days. And politically speaking, Latter-day Saints are mostly aligned with the Republican Party in this country. I think for most people, that's the way they think. And that's not surprising to hear Chris Stewart supporting the president at those hearings.
And to be clear, if I was a like a political reporter, I wouldn't be surprised by this. But I look at things through like the lens of religion.
Right.
And so when I look at politicians and the Christian right, because Mormons are often grouped in with the Christian right, same agenda, same viewpoints, Mormons theologically don't necessarily get along with the Christian right, or at least historically they're extremely different.
Yeah.
And it's just weird that these people at odds with each other theologically can sync up so well politically. And I am just curious as to why they're so synced up and what it would mean if you actually had to reckon with Mormon theology in light of how these Mormon politicians are acting.
It's interesting, too, because when Donald Trump first came on the scene in 2015, 2016, and a lot of us were really wondering just what members of the LDS Church were going to make of him. You know, would they end up supporting him? Because I don't know if you remember, of course, there was a lot of unease among Mormon politicians and rank-and-file Mormons about Donald Trump.
Right.
But heading now into the 2020 presidential race, there doesn't seem to be any reluctance anymore about Donald Trump. And it seems like the only acceptable position for a Mormon politician in this state anyway is to be all in for Donald Trump. And that's the thing that's got you confused. Like, how did we end up here?
Right. Even Mitt Romney's base.
Right.
When he pushes it back a little bit on Trump, that's when he catches flack, is for not supporting the loyalty, you know, this the president.
Yeah.
And so that's what's fascinating to me is it seems like Mitt Romney, people might say that there's no teeth in when he pushes back, but the right thing to do is to support. And when somebody like Mitt Romney shows a little bit of friction, that's what people find abhorrent.
So what you're trying to figure out and what we're getting into today is how this happened. That is, when was it that Mormons started to blend in with the religious right? Is that it?
Yeah, when, but also what happens if we take a theological approach to a very political moment? And I don't know if it's going to work, but I'm curious about viewing these things, which are often just viewed through a political lens in a way that believers feel about just the tenets of faith, like who God is and who your fellow man is, and what you're supposed to do when you're on this earth and where you go after you die. Like, what happens when you think about those questions in light of how people are acting politically? Maybe they don't belong together, but I think they do.
So we're going to be digging into the differences between Mormon theology and evangelical theology, but maybe just so we can make this clear for people, give us the basics. What are some of the major differences?
Well, it's easiest for me to say what a lot of Christians don't like about Mormonism.
Yeah.
And the main thing is that a lot of people accuse Mormons of not focusing on Jesus enough and not focusing on Jesus's grace, that too much weight is put on how to live your life, living your life in accordance with the standards of the church, and basically earning your way to heaven. That's a phrase you'll hear. Catholics are accused of it too, but especially Mormons. Another thing is the fact that Mormons believe, you don't hear it often talked about in public, but you'll become a god.
Yeah.
And that.
And evangelicals hate that.
They hate that. That is just repulsive.
Yeah.
So ultimately, I think that the biggest difference is that a lot of Christians see Mormons as elevating the individual too much, replacing Jesus and replacing God in a way that you should never do.
Okay, so let's jump in with our first guest. Tell us about Dr. Terrell Gibbons.
The Neil A. Maxwell Research Fellow at the Maxwell Institute at Brigham Young University.
Yeah, so Dr. Terrell Gibbons, professor at BYU. He works in the Maxwell Institute, which is kind of the theological arm of Brigham Young University.
We're not Christians in the historically, creedally defined sense. What we represent is a radical alternative.
He kind of nerds out about Mormon theology.
Okay, so say a little bit more about that, because Terrell Gibbons, for those who don't know, he's a Mormon intellectual, well thought of among the faith for sure, writes about and puts a real value on kind of the unique nature of Mormonism, right, as it compares to other Christian sects. He likes the fact that Mormons are distinct.
When I was sitting at a Q&A once with him after he was talking about one of his books, he said, "We're so worried about being Christians as Mormons." And he said, "I think we should stop worrying about fitting in," which kind of got me thinking. He's somebody who wants to emphasize how Mormons are different and not how they're the same with other Christians. And he tries to unpack why those differences matter.
And we should explain. So Gibbons is not from Utah. In fact, he grew up actually near the epicenter of evangelical Christianity. This is in Northern Virginia. And he grew up not far from Liberty University, and this is the university in the ministry of Jerry Falwell. And when Gibbons was growing up, Falwell was an extremely popular televangelist. And you probably know this. Evangelicals are suspicious of Mormons, don't at all like Mormonism. And in those days, they weren't shy about saying it in public.
My family, who owned a small business, we were personally blacklisted by Jerry Falwell. His members were forbidden to even shop at our business.
What was the business?
It was a bookstore.
And you were literally on a list?
Literally on a list.
The Gibbons family.
Because they knew you were Latter-day Saint.
Because they knew we were Mormon. Yep. And so some of his members actually showed us that list on which our name appeared. Jerry Falwell actually preached from the pulpit. There are three isms that should be wasms: atheism, communism, and Mormonism.
So someone like Falwell was literally fixated on Mormonism being kind of this scourge, like this really problematic belief that was attacking mainline Christianity. And this is the world that Gibbons was kind of born into. He wasn't a super stalwart Mormon growing up,
right.
But it didn't mean that he wasn't targeted by people who wanted to save his soul. In fact, he has memories of walking on the street and being approached by street preachers kind of on behalf of the Falwell mindset, people really concerned about his salvation.
My brother and I both were personally subjected to such evangelizing efforts on street corners where you'd be accosted by his members or missionaries who would try to save you by getting you to make an act of confession to Jesus Christ, and you would experience in that moment your salvation.
What would you say when they asked you if you
want
to be saved?
Well, you know, I wasn't even an active Latter-day Saint at that point in my life. And I just remember thinking, this word has no purchase with me. I felt no need for salvation. Saved from what? Hmm. It was a meaningless utterance. Now, if he had said, "Have you suffered injuries or wounds? Are you emotionally hurting in any way that you feel in need of a healer?" I think I at least would have been more responsive to that possibility, but certainly not the rhetoric of damnation and salvation. No.
So that's never been your thing?
It's never had any resonance in my mind, no.
I think this is important to understand where Givens is coming from, because for him, and he writes about this, and he talks about this all the time, like one of the key distinctions between the way the Mormons see God and the way other Christians see God is that the Mormon God is not set apart on high, is not this kind of amorphous thing. It's a personal God.
Right.
And this is really important to the way Givens sees the world.
Right. And I mean, there's a similar teenager who had questions about salvation as well, and that's Joseph Smith, famously feeling kind of pulled this way and that based on the doctrines of the time. And I think Joseph was told that this is a high-stakes thing, that your soul is at stake. And in creating Mormonism, one of the things that Joseph Smith taught that was heretical was that God was not passionless, that God cared about you in a way that almost felt human, that felt it's empathic and personal. And that's one of the primary things that Givens clings on to, is that Joseph Smith gave to Mormonism.
And there's a scripture in Mormonism we should explain where a prophet actually is amazed by the idea that someone so great as God could weep, could cry.
Right. So, I mean, we always talk about Joseph Smith translating the Book of Mormon, but there are other books of scripture he translated too, like the Book of Moses is an example. And in that book, you're right, literally a God who is weeping on behalf of what he sees happening on earth.
The official creeds of virtually the entirety of the Christian world, Catholic and Protestant alike. To take the Protestant example, the 39 Articles of the Church of England or the Westminster Confession of Faith, that's the foundational creed of mainstream Protestantism. And its second paragraph states, we affirm belief in a God without body parts or passions. By passions, what that creedal statement means is that God is incapable of being moved by human pain and suffering. God the Father does not participate in our pain or our joy. In 1830, we get a vivid description of a visitation, an ascension narrative where Enoch the prophet sees God, and God the Father, he identifies them as such, right? Man of holiness is my name. Three times Enoch asks him, how is it possible that you can be weeping? Okay, we find the same story in the book of Jacob, chapter 5, in the Book of Mormon. So Mormonism begins with a radical reconstruction of the nature of God as emphatically passable, passionate,
and relatable.
Vulnerable and relatable.
We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
What happens when a Mormon, a Muslim, and a rabbi walk into a bar? Join us at the Preach Podcast live show to find out. Special guests include comedian Stacey Harkey from JK Studios, co-founders of The Emerald Project, and a millennial rabbi. Plus live music and limited edition Preach swag. Preach Podcast Live is January 30th at the State Room in Salt Lake City. Tickets and info at preachpod.org/live.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring the relationship between Mormons and evangelicals when it comes to politics. You could say their conservative principles line up, but certainly not their theology. And KUER's Lee Hale wanted to know if, in the interest of getting along and being accepted, Latter-day Saints are just downplaying the parts of their faith that make them very different. So there's this key distinction now that Givens talked to us about. And I think this is really important to understanding sort of the way he sees all of that. There is a difference, he sees, between the Christians who see the point of faith as about salvation. As he said in our conversation, he was less interested as a young man in the idea of being saved as being healed.
Right.
And that's the other part. healing.
Yep.
For Givens, it's not about being saved. It's about being healed.
Right. And there's evidence in Mormonism, but he also looks to just the translation of the Bible over the years. He feels that this term salvation has been misunderstood, at very least emphasized too much. And he thinks that there's a different way to frame it. If you frame it about healing and not about your soul being at stake, that you see everything differently.
One of the pivotal concepts or terms in the Greek New Testament is the word sozo. It's a Greek word that primary meaning is to heal, to make well, to make whole, or to rescue. Time and time and time again in the New Testament, that word is used to describe Jesus' acts of healing. He heals the blind, the sick, the lame, even the dead. And it's always the word sozo that is employed. And yet at critical junctures where it seems an egregiously wrong translation, the Calvinist translators would translate that as save. So in Acts chapter 4, there's this pivotal scene where Peter has healed a lame man. And he says, he gives us this sermon. It's one of the first sermons in the New Testament to the Gentile or to the Jews. He says he's been healed by virtue of the power of Jesus Christ. So must all of you be, and then it uses the exact same word, sozo, but it's translated saved. And so my point is that if you look in the world today, right, we have the historically highest incidence of depression, of addiction, of loneliness, of all kinds of mental illnesses. We're a wounded people. And in the 1830 edition of the Book of Mormon, the prophet Nephi has a vision in which an angel is instructing him in the conditions that will prevail in the latter days. And he says there will be a state of awful woundedness. I think that's a powerful and resonant term for the condition of most people that we know, our friends and family and so on. We're wounded, we're hurting, we're ailing. Christ comes as the great healer. I think that's a message that will be much more powerful and much more resonant to the world than to say Jesus is going to save us from some imagined depravity or condition of sinfulness or alienation into which we have fallen by virtue of some act committed by mythological ancestors.
But what's the difference between, qualitatively different, what's different between saving and healing? One's more hopeful, one is more conditional? What's the difference?
Well, I think they both intimate a radically different point of departure for human nature and the human condition, right? If we begin with a typical Christian narrative, we all begin, our default position is that of sinfulness, depravity. We're lost. We're fallen. And so we have to be rescued from this condition of imaginary damnation. Whereas Latter-day Saint scripture teaches that we are whole from the foundation of the world. The crucible of learning and moral education to which we are subject in this life, it subjects us to all kinds of collateral damage from which we need healing and repair. And that's, I think, a powerful and fundamental difference between those two terms.
It seems like Givens is frustrated by the fact that Mormons don't lean into that distinction more, that I'm sure he's not troubled necessarily that Mormons get along with evangelicals, but he doesn't want Mormon theology to blend into that theology because he sees them as really different.
And this is why the phrase that keeps coming to my mind as we're talking to Givens is high-stakes Christianity, which he does not view Mormonism as. For instance, just to give an example when it comes to where we're going after this life, Mormon theology, as taught by Joseph Smith, is that God is going to give everyone as much of an opportunity to receive as much of heaven as they want. There's kingdoms of glory. There isn't even really a hell it's talked about.
Yeah.
So for Mormons, this idea of salvation to him, it seems kind of silly because we're not talking about damnation. We're talking about how much of God you want in your life. How healed do you want to be? Whereas the evangelical view, most of the Christian right are talking about heaven and hell, that you have to know where you're going. And the stakes are very, very high. And that mindset, it makes sense, can create a kind of combative worldview, that it can be us versus them. It can be the kind of a scarcity mentality. You can feel kind of like there is kind of this aggressive approach to how you should follow God. And kind of the Mormon view takes the wind out of that a little bit. It is hopeful. It is good news. And it's, to Terrell, it's more about healing than it ever is about your soul.
So I guess we could put it this way, Lee. Terrell Givens is not worried about Mormons fitting in.
No. He thinks that you lose a lot by fitting in. And for a long time, Mormons didn't fit in. That's the important thing, too.
Yeah.
For a long time, I mean, they literally moved across the country to get away from other Christians because they did not fit in and they needed a place where they could worship. Part of that had to do with polygamy, of course, mm-hmm. but also had to do with the fact that their worldview was drastically different. And he's worried that over the years, you know, Mormons have become a little too mainstream with their beliefs as a way to rub shoulders more comfortably with the Christian right.
We've been made to feel that we don't recognize Christ. We don't put him in the central place as we should. And so we've been reemphasizing the word grace. Well, we don't recognize that when a Protestant uses the word grace, they mean something vastly different than what a Latter-day Saint means by the word grace. For an evangelical, a grace usually has to do with the doctrine of imputed righteousness. It's the belief that a human being can never, even at his best, become righteous or good. Right? Luther said, we will always be vile sinners, and we will be saved in spite of our vile, sinful nature. The Book of Mormon explicitly condemns that as a heresy, the heresy of being saved in our sins. And James Talmage, in his canonical, semi-canonical work, declared that the doctrine of grace or imputed righteousness is a sinister doctrine. That's pretty harsh language. And I think we need to do more to differentiate what we mean on those occasions when we do use the word grace from what a Protestant means.
It's uncomfortable to disagree, though. It just is, right? you just moved from Virginia where your neighbors were, I'm guessing, not Mormon. People you rubbed shoulders with weren't Mormon. And so I feel like it only makes sense that after a while it's like disagreeing can be tiring and embarrassing.
Well, it can be. But it seems to me that to the extent that Latter-day Saints believe in the Great Commission, to the extent that they believe that they have a missionary or even evangelizing mandate, that I think it's important to recognize that, you know, the Titanic is sinking and we need to stop trying to swim back to it. I think that the healthiest and most productive and effective strategy that the church could employ today is to say, we're not what you may have understood to be the nature, what you understand Christianity to be or Christians to be. We're not Christians in the historically, creedally defined sense. What we represent is a radical alternative. And I think we need to do more to emphasize the radical difference between ourselves and mainstream creeds especially.
Okay, so now this gets us, I think, Lee, to your question, like when was it and how is it that Mormons started to try and fit in with evangelicals?
Yeah. And it's interesting because Jerry Falwell, who famously, as Terrell said, kind of made an enemy out of Mormon theology, saying that Mormonism should not exist, that it was a problem, also was famous for creating the moral majority. Basically, he needed, as a political activist, to get as many Christians on his side as possible to fight what he thought was the Christian, like the right Christian thing to do, to get behind the issues that should be front and center. And Mormons at that point, this is in the 70s, were useful to him. They could be a good partner. And they kind of made this, I guess, deal where they were going to go in together and, I guess, politically sync up.
Jerry Falwell formed the Moral Majority, and he found Latter-day Saints to be powerful assets and partners because we share with evangelicals many moral values of traditional sexual morality and monogamy and, you know,
so
forth.
A lot of the social issues.
A lot of the social issues. And so we both found it to our benefit to become allies in that regard. In the pre-1960s, the majority of Latter-day Saints were Democrat. But with the sexual revolution and the women's liberation movement, those moral and social issues that were foregrounded in American discourse were ones on which Latter-day Saints unilaterally came down on the conservative side.
Yeah.
And so I think in the decades since then, it's been largely a question of momentum. And it's hard to shift that momentum and recognize that, wait, there's a whole plethora of other moral issues on where the other party can make equal or superior claim to being in line with New Testament morality. And, you know, I'm of the opinion that, you know, Hugh Nibley was correct when he said, look, any Latter-day Saint looking out at the political world should see that we're given a devil's dilemma. I mean, any Latter-day Saint who thinks he can or she can be perfectly comfortable with either party platform is clearly putting politics above religion. It seems to me that at the present political moment, there's no question that what Latter-day Saints are confronted with is a choice of the lesser of two evils.
All right, just quickly, first, who's Hugh Nibley?
Hugh Nibley is basically Terrell Given's predecessor at BYU, interested in similarly how theology should affect how Mormons view the world and view politics.
So, Lee, do you think that Terrell Givens, and I guess maybe even Nibley before him, were seen as outliers?
This is the interesting thing, because Givens writes books that are sold at Deseret Book, which is the church's publishing arm, that I think people just love overall. The way he's talking about with healing and with the way you should view Jesus and this kindness, this hope, I think people theologically, Mormons theologically, can accept that wholeheartedly in many ways. Clearly, I mean, the books sell really well. But when you attach it to politics, kind of like we're forcing him to do a little bit here, that's when his views can become the views of an outlier, the views of somebody who is kind of subverting what people expect. And that's what I find fascinating. People will accept his views theologically. Once you start attaching them to the way that they operate politically, it's not as comfortable.
Well, that gets us to Donald Trump. Like, how it is that mainstream Latter-day Saints, certainly in this state, support a person like Donald Trump. I mean, I don't know if you saw the televangelist Jim Baker this week said basically supporting Donald Trump was a way to tell if a person was saved.
You know what? Trump is a test whether you're even saved.
Mm.
Only saved people can love Trump.
Supporting Donald Trump in a weird way has become a spiritual mission for a lot of people. And in that way, it's kind of forcing people to reconcile whether their beliefs sync up with supporting his leadership. And Terrell Given says if you're going to do that, if you're going to examine Donald Trump through a spiritual lens, then be honest about what you actually believe.
Are you disappointed that Latter-day Saints haven't been more outspoken about what to some is perceived as the immoral leadership of a man like Donald Trump?
You're trying to drag me into a conversation about politics. Absolutely. There's no question that any person of any kind of moral sensibility should be appalled by any number of pronouncements and behaviors of the leadership.
It's Terrell Givens. He's a fellow at Brigham Young University's Neil A. Maxwell Institute for Religious Scholarship. We're also here with Lee Hale. He's the host of the podcast Preach, about the messiness of faith. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. This is Radio West.
A recent NPR survey revealed that 21% of American adults now own at least one smart speaker. Maybe you have one, but you don't know what to do with it.
Smart speaker. What's the diameter of the world's largest pizza? When is Tan France's birthday? Set a reminder about my birthday and send it to the media.
Sure, you can ask it random questions, but your smart speaker is also an excellent way to listen to your favorite public radio station. Just tell your device, play KUER, or visit KUER.org for details.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So today in the program, we've been talking about political allies with theological differences, that is to say, Mormons and the religious right. Earlier, we were talking with Professor Terrell Givens about how he sees most of the Christian right as being salvation-focused, believing in, as he put it, a high-stakes Christianity with the very real threat of hellfire and damnation, whereas he says Mormonism is all about healing and second chances. a benevolent God, really closer to a Unitarian worldview. And Givens doesn't understand how it is that that kind of belief could translate to supporting someone like Donald Trump.
And now we want to introduce you to somebody who's not confused like Terrell is. Right. This is somebody who does not have a hard time seeing how Mormons can support Trump, even when you involve theology. This is Emily Coleman.
Politics was a thing that my dad and I did. I mean, it was like going to church, going to convention, and going to caucus.
She's a millennial who has worked most of her career for Utah's federal delegation.
Yeah.
She worked for Jason Chaffetz and then Chris Stewart afterwards.
And all in Republican.
All in. I mean, this was like kind of fulfilling a dream to work in these offices and to support these politicians. And when it came to Trump, she sees how that happened.
Yeah. And what's interesting about Emily, I think, for our purposes, is that I guess we could say that she's sort of the case study
right.
to illustrate Givens' theory.
Exactly. And we heard from Terrell Givens that he can't square Mormon theology and this conservative support for Trump. But for Emily, she has a very easy time seeing that connection. In fact, she thinks that Mormon theology, in a way, lends itself to supporting someone like Donald Trump. In particular, that Mormons often believe the ends can justify the means of kind of fulfilling God's will.
I will say that there is certainly a facet of Mormonism that the ends justify the means.
Mm-hmm.
That is pretty well baked into our doctrine. You think about Nephi and retrieving the brass plates and that story of essentially committing murder.
Murder, yeah. That's like the first story in the Book of Mormon is
right,
and somebody kills someone for the greater good.
Yeah, and you said—
not essentially, cutting off the man's head. Yeah,
right,
yeah, yeah.
Yes, because, you know, the whole idea is that, you know, better that one man should perish than a nation fall into unbelief. And I think that that is fundamentally, I don't think that any Mormon would say that outright, but to me that's what it is.
So here's the thing. Emily grows up in a house that is not at all about healing.
Right.
They're the other brand of Christianity that Terrell Givens talks about. Deeply Mormon, but more about the saving part, I guess.
And the timeline syncs up. So yeah. Emily's growing up in a household in the 80s and 90s. And Terrell Givens is worried that Mormons have kind of forfeited what makes them special in order to fit in. And so, yeah, she's born into a home where healing is not the point, that it is about salvation. It is high-stakes Christianity. There is a lot to worry about when it comes to your soul.
As a young child and being grown up in a very conservative Mormon home, we cared more about law. We cared more about following the rules. I didn't grow up understanding a compassionate Mormon God by any means. I grew up very anxious about my eternal salvation, and never once did it would very rarely enter my mind that mercy also went into that equation. That was also just not really how I was raised.
I find that so fascinating.
But Terrell Givens would be just mortified by this.
Yeah, no mercy, all law, right?
Yep.
Which syncs up with that view of, you know, salvation is this thing, that a fragile thing that you have to worry about, right? That God is judging you. And so this is her lens. This is how she sees the world. This is how she sees her faith. And she comes to the Republican Party and her conservative views kind of with that theological perspective. And for a long time, it works. For a long time, they're synced up. And it wasn't until she was married and far along into her career that she hit a real bump in the road. All of a sudden, she needed more out of her party than she kind of ever needed before.
So in 2009, my husband was diagnosed with brain cancer. And I was working for Jason Chaffetz at the time. And luckily, it had health insurance that was going to cover all of our medical bills. And Congressman Chaffetz was very supportive of me while we were going through this. His mother had passed away from cancer, and it was something that was deeply personal to him. And so he was very much looking out for me, you know, during that period. But then, you know, I started working for Chris Stewart in 2013, and the government shutdown happened. And a large part of the reason that the government was shut down was because several politicians wanted to remove the employer contribution for members of Congress and their staff for health insurance. They'd already moved us through Obamacare into the small business pool for Washington, D.C., so we were no longer considered federal employees and we're no longer in that group. They'd already moved us, but then the one of the big cruxes of this decision was, do we give them any money to offset health care premiums, or do we require our employees, many of whom are making less than $50,000 a year, to pay all of their health care premiums? And I saw politicians that I had campaigned for and who I understood to be, you know, good, decent, moral people lie about our health care coverage. And I was it shook me, and it probably shouldn't have. I mean, I was 25, but it was the first time I'd been confronted really with this reality that, like, they were lying about something that was mattered so deeply to me. I didn't feel like I was gaming the system. I was an employee, for goodness sakes. This was something that nearly every employer in America was doing, but they were acting like we were freeloading. And I couldn't believe it. I was distraught, and there really wasn't a lot of relief. I had talked to my chief of staff, and he was like, you know, however it works out, we'll make sure you're covered. But, like, there was no room in the law to do that. Like, it was all an empty promise. And after the government came back online and I thought about it, I decided to leave government service at that point. I decided I couldn't do it anymore. But it also triggered, as I thought about that and having that happen in front of me and feeling helpless to do anything about it, I thought, what other things in my life am I not questioning? What other things have I taken for granted?
So she literally is looking for healing.
Right. Her husband has brain cancer.
Yeah.
She needs her employer and therefore her political party to see her as a human who needs healing, her husband as a human who needs healing. And when she feels like they're looking past that, she's out.
Yeah. And it opens then a whole line of questions for her. And what's so interesting about Emily's story, I think, is that it didn't start with her questioning her faith. It started with her questioning her party.
They were so linked that once one started to wane a little bit, she had to look at the other thing. So she leaves her job because she can't feel like she can support this this career path she was on anymore. She can't support her party in the way that she used to. And then she immediately looks at her faith as well. What have I been trusting about this? What have I been leaning on that actually doesn't sync up with what I believe? And remember, she saw Mormonism as all about law, no mercy, all about this high-stakes salvation view. And she didn't want that anymore. She wanted healing. So as Emily is rethinking everything in her life, she decides to step away from her faith.
Which was more difficult, to give up some of the precepts of your, you know, lifelong faith, or the precepts of your lifelong party?
To me, it felt easier to give up Mormonism. I mean, I'm still registered Republican, and it's still, you know, when people ask me why I'm Republican, it's still a very hard question for me to answer, because a lot of days it's, I don't know. I understand what people look at me. They're like, I don't get how you can be Republican when you feel this way. I don't understand how you can leave Mormonism for all of these reasons but still stay aligned within the Republican Party. And I think part of it is just that after I left Mormonism, I felt unmoored. I felt like my Republicanism was the only connection I had, like, to a relationship with my dad, because my relationship with my family suffered so deeply after I left. I felt like I just didn't have any connection.
After
I left my faith, I didn't speak to my parents for a good 2-3 years. And our conversations that we did have were pretty strained and pretty bad. And over time, it's gotten a little better, and then it's kind of backtracked. Like, we just have a very tenuous relationship. But I felt like if I gave up Republicanism, if I gave up being a Republican, then who was I? Like, it felt like I didn't have any connection to my family or to my childhood. And I think the reason I was able to stay Republican and not Mormon was that I still felt like, well, with Mormonism, I can't really change it. I don't have much power as a woman in Mormonism. I will never have a position of power to do anything, really. in the way that I like. But as a Republican, I still have an opportunity to attend caucuses. I have an opportunity to run for office. I have an opportunity to speak about it. And I still have some power here. And maybe I can change it. Like somehow, if I just talk about it enough and if I stay here and continue to work on this, I can change it. I didn't feel like I could change Mormonism, but I still feel like I can heal or bring together some parts of Republicanism and still make it work.
You know, Lee, it seems a little kind of silly for people to be surprised that she is still Republican, as if to say that being a Republican somehow you're less compassionate, less moral. That's not what we're saying, and that's not what this is about. But it is interesting that she is in those two parts of her world, two important parts, you know, the ideological part, you know, the political part, the way you see the world that way, and the way you see the world in a religious way. Both of those are really up in the air for her right now.
Right. And maybe this speaks specifically to Utah Mormonism, but it would be hard to overstate how connected that political identity and that religious identity are for her and for many people. And I think what people are surprised at is how can you not just toss them out together? And that's what she's realizing as well, right? If I'm going to reassess my political views and my religious views, I kind of should reassess them at the same level, on the same path. And there's dissonance there for her.
And it's interesting that the thing that keeps her for now in the Republican Party isn't about principle. It's about her relationship with her dad.
So part of me, a lot of me worried that we just wouldn't have anything in common anymore. And I felt like, well, as long as I believe a little bit of it, and I had I've had my own cognitive dissonance about I'm going to pick which parts of the Republican Party work for me and which don't, very much how I've picked out the parts of Mormonism that work for me.
You're a cafeteria Mormon, right?
I am. Yeah. I am at this point. I feel like Mormonism is a thing you can't wash off, and so I've embraced that that's my heritage, and I'm proud of it. I feel like it makes me who I am. So much of who I am is because I'm Mormon, and I feel like not abandoning that and not abandoning Republicanism, but sort of deciding I'm going to do it how I want to, makes me feel more empowered than if I were to say, now I'm atheist and Democrat. That to me doesn't feel authentic to how I feel and how I've become. I just am not that. And so, you know, claiming these identities, but saying I am Republican and people can tell me I'm not Republican, but they don't get to decide that because I get to choose when I register what I identify as, and there is no mechanism to expel me.
So where do you think all of this is headed with Mormonism and politics, at least for now? And I'm thinking particularly about young Latter-day Saints like Emily, like the millennial generation, who are thinking differently politically. Can you imagine, at least right now, a shift back toward maybe the softer side of the faith, you know, away from high-stakes Christianity and more toward, you know, compassion and second chances?
Well, and softer is one word for it, but it's also, I think, human.
Yeah.
And I think, like Carol Givens is saying, it is about healing. This is about, it's useful, it's needed. This is a time where people, I think, want healing and that it's, like, evident. It's not taboo to talk about therapy openly, you know, like people are trying to improve themselves and to grow and to change. I think that the outcome I'm thinking about with this is that I think it's wrong to think that, you know, there's some incongruencies with Mormonism and the conservative agenda, therefore Mormons should be liberal and Democrat. Like, I don't think that's not the conclusion I came to. That's not the clean answer. I think it's just really hard with a theology like Mormonism to fit into a polarized political world. It's really hard to know how a theology like Mormonism should motivate somebody politically. And it makes sense that it's easier to just kind of adopt someone else's views when it comes to, like, political warfare, like when it comes to us against them, because Mormonism doesn't give you a lot of teeth in that fight. Mormonism kind of disarms you in a way. You don't see people as enemies. You see them as brothers and sisters, literally, who have just as much access to God and to heaven as you do. So I think that Mormon theology is just really inconvenient when it comes to politics.
Do you feel like you got somewhere close to an answer to your question?
I think that what we saw Emily struggling with, which is, can you divorce these things? Mm-hmm. I think that they are becoming divorced. I think that Mormonism and the political agenda usually expected, this conservative political agenda, I think those are starting to separate. I don't think that there's any good conclusion as to what fills the gaps then. I think that, yes, I think younger Mormons are going to challenge the expectation of where they align politically. They're also bucking trends with what they do with orthodoxy. They're just not as faithful as their previous, you know, as the previous generations. So I think that this given, this expectation of the Mormon politician sounding and advocating for someone like Donald Trump the way it's happening right now, I do think that is not the future, but it is really murky and hard to understand what the future looks like.
K.W. Arsley Hale. Lee, thanks.
Thanks.
Reporter Lee Hale. He's the host of the podcast Preach, about the messiness of faith. You can download it wherever you get your podcasts. Radio West is a production of KUER, and you can also subscribe to our show. And as always, we want to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard, Ali Vallarta, and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.